Hello, I'm Paul Parker. This is number 0265, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
There, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0265. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, adventurer George Karunas is back on the show, this time to talk about his trip to the mouth of a volcano in Vanuatu.
I was drawn to it. I wanted to go there for 10 years. The opportunity just came up to go there. And what I'm really liking about this is that people are seeing the video and they can't believe their eyes. But really, there are spots like this on Earth. And this sort of mission was less scientific and more an exercise to show people what is out there and get people interested in nature and our planet and things like that. Not necessarily studying and taking gas measurements and things like that. I just wanted to showcase our planet.
Relationship expert Tani Carr shares her personal connection to the late comic Joan Rivers. At one time, she worked for the legend.
I found her to be extremely genuine, down to earth, and all business. You know, the business of comedy is a serious business. Anybody who can maintain the laughter for audiences over an extended period of time knows that it takes a huge amount of effort and work to make it look like it's effortless and stuff just rolls off your tongue. She was very professional, very nice, very giving.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter takes a look at author Harper Lee with The Mockingbird Next Door. Great author, great book, and a great segment coming up soon. Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0265 was Paul Parker from Shaw Media in Toronto. Thank you very much, Paul, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? An Oregon woman, accused of breaking into a woman's home and biting the resident, allegedly told a victim she was playing the zombie game. The Coos County Sheriff's Office said Jessica Roca was caught trying to break into Eric Tate's lakeside home, and the suspect allegedly attacked Tate by pushing her down the stairs, pulling her hair, and biting her. Deputies responded to the scene just before 1 a.m., and Roca was arrested on charges of first-degree attempted burglary, fourth-degree assault, harassment, unlawful entry to a motor vehicle, and third-degree criminal mischief. Tate told deputies Roca told her that during the attack that she was playing the zombie game. There was no word on exactly what the zombie game the suspect was referencing. But let's just say that a checkup from the neck up might be required for this particular undead. Moving right along, an alleged shoplifter in Michigan made an ultra-low-speed getaway on a motorized Walmart shopping cart because she didn't feel like walking, according to police. Police were called when a Walmart customer in Fruit Point Township saw 46-year-old Shirley Mason leaving the store's parking lot with the motorized shopping cart. Officers located the suspect and an alleged male accomplice about 2 miles away from the store. Mason, who police said had an outstanding warrant for her arrest stemming from a previous incident at a Walmart store in Roosevelt Park, of course, allegedly had up to $600 worth of stolen goods loaded onto the $1,200 motorized cart. The police report said Mason told officers she took the cart because she didn't feel like walking. Mason was arrested on a charge of organized retail crime, in addition to the charge of second-degree retail fraud from the previous incident in Roosevelt Park. She is due in court September 23rd. The 53-year-old man with Mason, who was also arrested on an alleged parole violation, of course he was, his name was not released. You know, there are petty criminals, and then there are lazy criminals, and I think Shirley is actually in both categories. A Florida man who called 911 while fleeing police to report that he had done nothing wrong had marijuana stuck to his face when he was stopped. The Volusia County Sheriff's Office said deputies attempted to pull over the vehicle driven by 26-year-old, aptly named Benjamin Nutter, because his tags were not lit. But the man then drove his vehicle into a shopping center parking lot and continued to drive slowly. Deputies said they noticed Nutter reached for a cup in his car and dump out the contents before driving out of the parking lot. Nutter allegedly dialed 911 while the deputies were pursuing him. "My hands are on the wheel, sir. I have done nothing wrong," Nutter told the dispatcher. However, deputies said they approached Nutter's car when he finally stopped and discovered that he had marijuana stuck to his face and the inside of the car from his apparent attempt to dump the illicit substance out. Nutter was arrested on charges of making a false call to 911, possession of marijuana, and fleeing and eluding. Now, some people really do live up to their names, don't they? And gee, I really had hoped that the marijuana was still stuck to his face when he took his mugshot picture. That would have been interesting. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police responded to a 911 call reporting a man slumped over the wheel of his car in McDonough. When they arrived, the man was still there, the engine was running, and his foot was on the brake, but the driver was asleep. Startled by officers, the man took his foot off the brake and started to roll. And then he put his car into park when an officer told him to do so. At least he was obedient. He identified himself as Robert Eugene Mobley and said he didn't have a driver's license. It was suspended after a DUI. Of course it was. They always are. The 2-year-old boy that was with him? Oh, that was his son, Mobley said. The bag of white powder? Cocaine, he said. Had he been drinking? Just one beer, he said. But he failed a field sobriety test and was again arrested for DUI. The boy wasn't seatbelted or in his car seat since that was already occupied by a whiskey bottle. Which kind of tells you which one he loved more, huh? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? We have spoken to George Karunas before. He's a renowned global adventurer, storm chaser, explorer, and television presenter. He documents nature's worst weather conditions, and that's taken him around the world. But recently, I think he's really outdone himself. He literally went into the mouth of an active volcano in Vanuatu, and he's alive to tell the tale. George is on the line with us right now from Los Angeles via Skype to Skype Communications. Hi, George.
Hi, how's it going? Good to talk to you again.
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So I saw the video, and the first thing that came to my mind is, why are you trying to kill your mother?
You know what? That's so funny because I actually haven't talked to my mother since that video came out. I'm afraid to call her up. I've given her quite a few gray hairs over the years, and I think everyone on the planet has by now pretty much seen this volcano video, and it looks really scary and it looks really dangerous, and well, that's because it was.
Okay, now one of the things, you do all this and you go all over the place, and I understand the storm thing because it helps people, it's scientific, but besides the wow factor of what you did, what did you get to learn by being at Vanuatu?
Well, interestingly, it's one of these spots on the planet that very few people have ever had the opportunity to get to, so I was drawn to it. I wanted to go there for 10 years. The opportunity just came up to go there. And what I'm really liking about this is that people are seeing the video and they can't believe their eyes. But really, there are spots like this on Earth. And this sort of mission was less scientific and more an exercise to show people what is out there and get people interested in nature and our planet and things like that. Not necessarily going, you know, studying and taking gas measurements and things like that. I just wanted to showcase our planet because we spend so much time going from our house to our air-conditioned car to our air-conditioned office. We don't get the chance to appreciate this beautiful gem that we're sitting on sailing through space. And there's some really great spots out there that no one gets to go to.
Now, I kid you not, when I first saw the video, I actually wheeled away from my screen. I really did.
You had a physical reaction.
I had a physical reaction. The scene where you're standing literally at the lip of that boiling volcano, I wheeled back going, whoa.
Mission accomplished then. That's good. I want people to not just look at it. I want their jaw to hit the floor and have that physical reaction. So I take that as a compliment. Standing on that spot, though, was very tricky because it was a 1,200-foot descent down into this crater. That's huge. I compare it to the Empire State Building. It's about the same height. And, you know, that was very difficult to get down there. And when you're on the edge, the heat is so intense. And you see me in that – I look like a baked potato in this in this aluminum suit, right? And it protects me from the heat. And without it, I could only stand in that spot for maybe 4 seconds.
Okay, well, give us an idea. What, besides the heat of the volcano, well, like when you put that suit on, does the suit itself feel hot just away from the volcano?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It doesn't. Aluminum's not very breathable, as you can imagine. So it's the kind of thing that you, when you wear it and you're walking around or trying to do anything, you trap a lot of your own body heat into the thing. But what it's very good at is reflecting radiant heat. And those suits, they're used for things like firefighters and steel mill workers. So I was able to, well, I have a couple of these in my basement, believe it or not. I've got tubs with all my different volcano gear and climbing equipment. And one of them is labeled volcano suits. So the problem I ran into there was that the volcano creates a lot of acid rain. The gas cloud that comes out of the volcano, when it rains and passes through that gas cloud, it creates sulfuric acid rain that's really strong. And it actually dissolved the metal on the heat suit.
Wow. Now, has anyone done what you've done? In other words, were you concerned about maybe you've gone too far for what the suit or your crew or anybody else can handle?
No, actually. Interestingly, I was able to team up with some New Zealand volcano experts. These guys are colleagues of mine, guys I've been communicating with for quite some time, Jeff Mackley and Brad Ambrose, and they have been down inside this crater a number of times before. So it's not the first time that this has been done. It's just that this particular instance, it just caught the attention of the world. And very, very few people have been down there, but it was absolutely just, you know, I look at the video and so many people online have been posting comments saying, oh, this is fake. It was done with a green screen. And I'm the guy in the shot. I was there. And to me, it doesn't look real.
Hmm. Now, one of the other things that concerned me, I mean, I'm no scientist, so I don't know the literally the ins and out of, you know, the difference between rock and molten lava and so on and so forth and what rock melts at. When you were standing on the edge, I was always concerned about it crumbling underneath you.
Yes, that was absolutely a concern. That one crazy hero shot where I'm standing there and the lava looks like a waterfall behind me. I'm on this one little rope and I'm standing, leaning over the edge as close to the lava lake as you can humanly get. And the ground is so unstable that it's breaking away under my feet. And I keep having to shift my weight, shuffle around because pieces keep dropping off. And there's a tiny ledge that's below me, right at the edge of the lava lake. I couldn't go down there because the lava kept splashing up onto that ledge continuously, and it was breaking away quite frequently. So you could not get any closer without basically swimming in it.
Okay, I will not send this last audio clip to your mother. I'll tell you that right now.
That's too late.
It's just...
Her hair is all gray by now.
No.
It's interesting. My family now is pretty much desensitized, so over the years... So that could do pretty much anything, and they barely bat an eye now.
In one of the videos, one of the parts of the videos, you were also on a rope kind of over an area.
In the volcano?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we had to use quite a few ropes. The ropes we had were simply just not long enough to get down to the bottom. So we had to do these multi-stage pitches to get down to the bottom, kind of like the reverse of climbing a mountain.
Right.
And then there was one rope at the very end that was bolted to a rock, and that's the one that I used to sort of lean myself out way, way over the edge there to get that perfect shot to line up the camera with myself and the lava lake.
Mm.
So we were conscious about how this was going to look on video. We were actually position the camera with just the right lenses and everything to get that shot to make it look as dramatic as possible. And then after that, we walked right up to the edge with our big wide GoPro lenses, you know, just to show you how majestic this place is. And when you're walking around the bottom, the really interesting thing of many interesting things about this place is that it sounds like it's raining. And you're constantly being bombarded by what feels like rain, and sometimes it was rain, but the volcano is constantly churning and burping out these little rocks and these little strings of rock called Pele's hair. And you're constantly being bombarded by these little things, and it's so weird. And these Pele's hair, they're like, it's kind of like a human hair, but it's made out of rock. And you end up getting these rock splinters in your fingers and anywhere you touch anything.
Wasn't there a point where you were talking to your crew and you said that there was seemed to be a burst of air that seemed to cool things down a little bit?
I think you're confusing this, the Turkmenistan expedition I did last year.
Okay.
Over the flaming gas crater.
Okay.
Lots of so many things that look like hell that they sometimes get kind of mixed up. Last year I led an expedition to Turkmenistan for
right.
National Geographic Channel.
Yes, that, yes, there, yes.
That's the one, yeah, where I had the ropes suspended over top of this flaming crater, and it went out to the middle and then dropped down to the very bottom. And yes, it was literally this burning pit about 230 feet across and 100 feet deep, filled with burning methane. So there's thousands of fires inside this pit, and I became the first person to ever touch down at the bottom. And as a matter of fact, I wore the same heat protective suit for both expeditions.
Yes, that's what I thought. Okay, so Turkmenistan and now Vanuatu, what's left?
Oh, there's a big world out there, Peter. There's lots to see. In October, I'm heading to Madagascar to go into a place called the Singi de Bemaraha, and it's one of the world's most inaccessible places. It's in a remote part of Madagascar. And the terrain there is nothing but these sharp spires of limestone that go on and on and on for miles. And they're so sharp, if you were to fall and land on one of these things, it would just totally impale you. And it's considered impenetrable. So we're going to try and penetrate this thing, go in there. And my role in the expedition is to search for undiscovered cave systems, places where no human has ever set foot.
Wow. Getting back to Vanuatu for just one more minute. When you were there on your way to the volcano, or back from the volcano, at what point did you stop seeing other living creatures or plants? Or what were the plant life like around the volcano? Was it very lush? Was there anything around it? Or?
There was nothing around it. It's interesting because Ambram Island, where this volcano is, the bottom part is extremely lush jungle. It's beautiful. And then as you get up the flanks of the volcano, you get less and less and less vegetation. And then up at the surface, it's nothing but just ash and rock and the occasional rat. There's not really anything else other than that. And we had a dog from the village with us. And that was pretty much it. We were the only living things inside the crater. Although I've heard stories about bats that do fly down inside. I'm not sure why. Maybe they like the heat. I don't know. But it's very much a moon landscape up there. Very lunar.
And how many people are on your crew besides the dog?
The dog, yeah, there was the dog, and then about six or seven of us that were sort of part of the core team that had the camp set up and getting the ropes rigged and everything. And we made two descents to the bottom, and there were three of us on each of those descents.
Well, again, it's fascinating stuff. Nowadays, you can see just about everything there is to see online and on the web, and therefore, when you go to YouTube or any place, you know, there's not a lot that people will stop and go, whoa, you've done it. I've got to say that you've really, really done it. People could also check out your website, furiouserth.com, correct?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I've got all my old adventures on there, hurricanes, tornadoes, other volcanoes, you name it. I've probably been there.
Well, continued success, George, and please look both ways when you cross the street, huh?
Yeah, exactly. That's what's going to happen to me, you know. It's going to be one of those things where a washing machine lands on my head or I get hit by a bus.
Thanks for being on the program, George.
Cheers, man. Thank you.
Adventurer George Karunas. Again, his website is furiouserth.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0265, and you'll find the links to George's website.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, we'll remember Joan Rivers with someone who used to work for her. Plus, Stuart Nauman is in with another edition of Book Banter. And of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day. Plus, lots more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, the district attorney in Ohio County, West Virginia, is mulling over how to charge a couple found walking along a busy intersection on Route 40 at 9:30 in the morning. The woman had the man on a leash. He was on his hands and knees, was wearing only a collar and a hood, and his ankles were bound. Let me repeat that. He was wearing only a collar and a hood, and his ankles were bound. The woman was reportedly wearing a nightgown. They said it was a consensual sex game, and they were offended that people were stopping and calling them freaks, said Sheriff Lieutenant Nelson Croft. Other than obvious ligature marks on his feet and ankles, Croft said he denied any injury. We won't be going into the other thing. Okay, now I want to know what the other thing is. Croft identified the couple as Robert Dale, age 56, and his girlfriend Barbara Jean Gardello, age 53, who goes by the name BJ. Of course she does. Croft was quick to add that both were originally from Pennsylvania. That was the weirdest day ever, Croft concluded. At least, he added, I hope it was the weirdest day ever. Whoa, boy, if he doesn't know if this was the weirdest day ever, if something else more bizarre than this has slipped his mind over the years, maybe it's time to take off the badge. Wow. This brings a whole new meaning to doggy style, doesn't it? They don't know what to charge these people with? I mean, he's naked wearing a collar, bound and has a hood on. Just the naked part alone at 9:30 in the morning should give you cause for concern. But anyway, let's move on. Still with kinky stuff, in a strange kind of way. Boone County, Missouri Sheriff Deputy's Cyber Crimes Task Force nabbed a 56-year-old man who posted an ad on Craigslist looking for two animals to have sex with. Detectives revealed one of the animals was a dog, but were apparently too shocked to reveal what the other animal might be. Again, now I'm kind of curious. Detectives offered up a dog, and Gerald L. Hill described in detail the sexual acts he wished to accomplish with the dog. Hill, who lives in a town of Roach, traveled to Columbia to have sex with the dog, they say, and was arrested when he arrived. He was carrying a bag of doggy treats. Ooh. The Windermere Baptist Conference Center in Roche, and you're wondering why I'm bringing them up? Well, let me finish the sentence and you'll know. Okay, I have to go back now. The Windermere Baptist Conference Center in Roche said it planned to fire Hill. He was the president and CEO of the religious retreat. Well, that brings new meaning to the term rough sex, doesn't it? I'm also guessing there really isn't an appropriate Bible passage that could explain this one. But I'm sure that our friend Gerald L. Hill will try to find one. A massage parlor in Rutherford, New Jersey was raided and found to be a front for prostitution. Oh, quel surprise. Two employees present during the raid were arrested. Police got a tip from a woman who attended yoga class across the street who thought there was illegal activity going on there. Acting on that tip, an undercover officer went in and was offered a sex act for $60, he testified. Now, what caught the tipster's attention, leading her to call the police, you ask? Oh, I'm so glad you did. She saw her husband going into the business while she was doing her yoga and went over to investigate. She does yoga her way, he does yoga his way, but I guess what she saw just rubbed her the wrong way. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the average alcohol-consuming Briton spends nearly a year of their life, that's 315 days, with a hangover, a charity survey indicates. Macmillan Cancer Support said the one poll survey of 2,000 people conducted July 24th to August 6th suggests the average Briton spends at least 7 hours each month with a hangover, while 7% of those polled are projected to have approximately 3,024 hangovers in their lifetimes. The charity said it took an average number of hours respondents spent hungover each month and multiplied it by the average lifespan starting at 18, the legal drinking age in Briton. To calculate that an average Briton spends about 315 days of their life, nearly a year, feeling the ill after effects of a drunken night. Now, the survey also found 10% of respondents had missed a job interview and 8% had missed a wedding because they were too hungover to properly function. Now, this research shows hangovers are a waste of time and are causing people to miss out on everything from romance to their dream job. That's why we're asking people to sign up for Macmillan's Go Sober fundraising event, abstain from drinking alcohol for the month of October, and ask family and friends to sponsor them. The money raised will provide vital funds to support people affected by cancer so that they don't have to face it alone, said Hannah Redman, who is head of national events marketing for Macmillan Cancer Support. Okay, this is kind of odd to me. First of all, I'd like to know where they conducted this poll, because if they conducted it, say, in a bar, that's going to skewer the numbers, don't you think? And it's also interesting that a charity to raise funds for a disease is piggybacking on the misery of another disease, alcoholism, to raise funds. Isn't that kind of odd? I don't know. Let's just get to our next guest, shall we? The late Joan Rivers would have been happy with the Hollywood send-off she got at her funeral, from the New York Gay Men's Chorus singing show tunes to Howard Stern giving the eulogy. There were body moments, spectacular Broadway performances, and laughter. Rivers was a household name known for poking fun at everyone, including herself. But she was much more than what the public saw. Tanny Carr is an author and relationship expert who at one time worked for Joan. She also had a small part in her movie, Rabbit Test. Tanny is on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Tanny.
Hello there, Peter. Nice to be with you and your audience.
Nice to talk to you. And my condolences, obviously, to the passing of a friend and a former work colleague.
Yes, absolutely.
So what was the real Joan Rivers like? I had an opportunity to meet her on a couple of occasions backstage in Montreal, but from your perspective, what was the real Joan Rivers like?
Well, I had a unique opportunity because I was working out of her home. So the Joan Rivers that is in front of the audience is that performer, is that entertainer. I found her to be extremely genuine, down to earth, and all business. You know, the business of comedy is a serious business. Anybody who can maintain the laughter for audiences over an extended period of time knows that it takes a huge amount of effort and work to make it look like it's effortless and stuff just rolls off your tongue. She was very professional, very nice, very giving, very genuine. I found her to be just very genuine and a genuinely nice and very giving person. An example of that is that she had a closet called her gift closet, and when she'd be out traveling or she'd go into Beverly Hills, she would find things at Tiffany's, find things at different lovely retail stores. She would have them gift wrapped, put them in a closet, and when she went someplace or was visiting somebody or was doing an interview, she would go into the closet and pull out something because she would want to give a gift to the person that she was meeting with or whatever, depending on the individual. So that's pretty special for an individual to do because she sure didn't have to.
Right. Now, as you described her, there's a sense of surprise in the personality that Joan was in real life. Was it a surprise to you when you met her?
No, it wasn't, because I had by that time already worked on her movie Rabbit Test, enjoyed working with her. Again, I had a small part. I was happened to be in some scenes with Billy Crystal, and I had a chance to get to meet her then. But also, my sister-in-law had been her personal assistant for 2 years, so I knew from her the sort of individual that Joan was, and she was everything that my sister-in-law had said that she would be, and then some. It was just nice to have the personal experience with her to see for myself.
Do you think, and again, the time frame we're talking about when you were working with her is quite a few years ago, correct?
Right. That would have been in the 1977, 78 was that period of time.
Had you kept in contact with Joan through the years?
Do you know, I did for a short time, because it turned out that the scenes that I was in with Billy Crystal were the scenes that she used to promote that movie, Rabbit Test, all over the country. So I saw her at the studio for that. But I must say that because of her long-term relationship with my sister-in-law, that for 5-6 years after Barbara was no longer working for her, she maintained contact with Joan, and whenever my brother and her were in Las Vegas, Joan invited them to the show, she comped them, she was always extremely generous, and she maintained that relationship, which I must say is consistent with her, with all the people that have worked for her, that she has maintained relationships over long periods of time. She's very, very loyal to the people that worked for her.
She has left behind an amazing legacy of comedy, not only the pioneering fact of what she did as the type of comedy she did, but even a pioneer as a woman telling jokes on stage. Even as far back as when you worked with her then, she had a reputation for what she had done up until that point. Was she aware of her legacy even then?
You know, I'm not so sure that she was aware of her legacy. I don't think that she thought in those terms. I do think that she was committed to her craft and expanding it to whatever degree she could. There have been video interviews, I think, on YouTube of her talking about the fact that while she was delighted that there were other comedians that followed her in her footsteps, that thanked her for her contributions, she was so much out in front and creating her future that she wasn't looking necessarily to be some icon, but she was very dedicated to her craft and really worked at it, and I'm sure she got pleasure out of her inspiration to other folks in that field.
It almost sounds like her life could be described as the Italian racing style, full speed ahead and no rearview mirror.
That's great. I may use that sometime. That's a good way to describe it. She definitely was racing toward, you know, what else can I do? What else can I do, for sure? Even certainly after Edgar died, she really realized that, hey, now it's up to me. I have a daughter to raise to be with, and I really need to really, really move on from this tragedy, which definitely impacted her greatly.
And I know for a bit of time after Edgar's death that there was a bit of a rift between herself and Melissa, which she, both of them overcame.
Well, they both overcame it Which really, in any family relationship, these things happen, not so much in the public eye. But keep in mind that when I was working for her and when I knew her, Melissa was only 8 years old. So, and the fact of the matter is that both Joan and Edgar were very doting parents. They both went to pick up Melissa at school every day. They had servants that could have done that, the household help. But they were committed to being parents with her. They went to the Girl Scout meetings. They did so much with Melissa. But that was the era that I was involved with her. But not surprising, sometimes people do have rifts within families, and just very, very happy that they were able to resolve those.
I mentioned in the introduction her send-off in New York, and it was something that she actually wrote about in one of her books, the type of funeral that she wanted to have. You think she would have been happy with that?
I think she would have been thrilled. I think she would have been absolutely thrilled. What was amazing to me was the huge turnout of A-list celebs from different areas of the arts who showed up for her funeral. It was, I mean, yes, I knew she was popular, and I knew she had a broad range of friends and people that she's been friends with for many years. But, oh, my gosh, to see the number of people that came together to honor her was really inspiring, and I very much enjoyed seeing that.
Well, she was an inspiration to many. She had an amazing career. She's left a great legacy, whether she knew it or not. She has done that. I thank you for talking with us about Joan, but I want to, before we let you go, talk a little bit about you, because you have a pretty remarkable story yourself, and it's something that you wrote about in your book called 10 Weeks to Love. Can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, I've been a writer and PR person. I've worked in television and radio for 40 years, and I finally wrote my book about how I met my husband, who's 16 years my junior, and we got married after 1 month of meeting, and it was 28 years now, and he still thinks I'm eye candy. So I know what I did to transform myself from miserable and divorced, and I wrote about it in the book, and it's a fun read, and I'm changing people's lives, and I must tell you how gratifying that is.
Now, as you said, you were divorced. As a matter of fact, to be honest, you were divorced twice, right?
Yes. And yes, I was divorced twice. And at 45, I had to start over again. And that was certainly difficult.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you are an author and a relationship expert. So is it through the stumbles that you took earlier in your life that led you to becoming a relationship expert?
Absolutely. No question about it. I had some harsh lessons to learn, and sometimes we have to have our necessity level rise up and smack us in the face to kind of go, I need to make some changes here. And the changes were all internal. They were not external changes. People, the number one question I get asked is, where do you go to find love? And I have to tell those people it is almost irrelevant, because I never could have planned how I met my husband. It's more about you being open to finding love, and you getting rid of your own stumbling blocks, which is really what the book is about. But it's done in a very upbeat, funny, and entertaining way. At least that's what I'm told by the people that have read it.
Well, actually, one of the things I want to ask you is the fact that you did have these hardships earlier in life where you stumbled through a couple of relationships. Do you think you had to do that to get to the point where you were when you met your husband-to-be?
You know, I would love to be able to answer that and say, no, I didn't need to go through that. But the truth is, each of us has an individual journey that we're on, and we have to do whatever we do. Some folks are fortunate enough, and I've met a bunch of them, who found their true love early on, been married forever, thrilled to be together. There are lots of people out there like that. This was not my situation. It just wasn't. I mean, I wish I could say that it was, but hopefully through my book, people can get this idea. I don't have to go through that. Tawny already went through it. Let me learn from her. Let me stand on her shoulders, and then I won't have to. And that's what I genuinely hope. It's not only to help older folks reinvent themselves, if that's what they need to do, to find the loves of their lives, but to help younger people who haven't been down that road, who don't need to, with the right direction. So that's my hope anyway.
The book is called 10 Weeks to Love, and people can find out more information by going to your website, which is 10weekstolove.com, and that's numerical 10, weeks, numerical 2, love.com. And again, thank you very much for talking about Joan Rivers and sharing your memories of her. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate being able to say good things about this amazing woman. So thanks for asking me, Peter. I appreciate it.
Relationship expert Tani Carr. It was great to talk about Joan Rivers from someone who worked with her. And again, you can find out more about Tani's book, 10 Weeks to Love, by going to her website. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0265, and you'll find links to her site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. From time to time, we hear news reports about prisoners filing frivolous lawsuits. They have a lot of time on their hands and can cause a lot of trouble. According to court records, one inmate in federal prison has already filed 3,356 lawsuits this year. Last year, he filed more federal lawsuits than all of the federal cases that were filed in the states of Maine, New Hampshire, and Wyoming combined. Almost all of his lawsuits are over the same thing, the quality of his prison food. Let's be fair, prison food will never top anyone's menu, but every one of his lawsuits have been dismissed. In the meantime, it's taxpayers who will eat the cost for all of this. In one state alone, California, taxpayers spent nearly $200 million just to defend inmate lawsuits over the past 15 years. These criminals may be behind bars now, but they're still robbing us by filing frivolous lawsuits. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder. But here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is, for some reason still giddy about the Green Mountain State. Here's Stuart Nauman.
Well, what do you think I'm, Ethan Allen, for crying out loud?
Come on over to our house.
Yeah, well, you know, I hope people will remember Ethan Allen for his contribution to American history than just furniture, you know?
Yes, yes.
But I was in Vermont earlier this summer. And just to say that I stumbled upon a bookstore in Manchester, Vermont. It's in the southern part of the state. Beautiful little town, has great outlet stores. But I went to a place called North Shire Bookstore. And it's if you thought that the independent bookstore is a thing of the past, you got to go to this place. It looks small from the outside, but inside it's huge. Great selection of new books, rare books, secondhand books. It's always schedules of author appearances of like you wouldn't believe. And I was just so amazed that an independent bookstore in a small town could be so large and could have a huge selection, and it's always busy. I was so impressed by this bookstore. You got to go check it out. It's called North Shire Books. It's on Main Street in Manchester, Vermont, 4869 Main Street. And you want to find out all the different activities that this store does, just go on their website at www.northshire.com. I love this store. It's the type of store that you had to drag me out of there.
Yes, and by the way, it's funny you should mention that. Drag you out of there, also yeah. Stumbled into, because, you know, you finding a bookstore in a new city is like a drunk finding a bar.
and it's
the same explanation. I had to be dragged out of there. I stumbled into it. That's exactly what's been going on with you in bookstores.
It's very intoxicating, let me tell you. But this is worth it. North Shire Bookstore. Gotta go to this place.
Okay. What are we talking about this week?
Book Banter. Speaking of quality bookstores, we're going to talk about a quality book, To Kill a Mockingbird, to be exact. Because, you know, since its publication in 1960, Peter, To Kill a Mockingbird has become one of the most beloved, highly regarded books in the history of modern American literature. The story of sage lawyer Atticus Finch and his children Jem and Scout and their life in the mythical town of Maycomb, Alabama, during the Great Depression, has sold over 40 million copies, won the Pulitzer Prize, became an Academy Award-winning movie that starred Gregory Peck, and has become a mainstay in many high school English class curriculums across North America to this day. Now, another reason why To Kill a Mockingbird is attractive to readers is the elusive nature of its author, Harper Lee. She echoed many aspects of her life growing up in Monroeville, Alabama, in the book, and when it became such an immediate sensation, she quickly eschewed the fame and celebrity that went along with being a best-selling author. In fact, she is one of those literary rarities in which she will forever be associated with her first book, and is such a massive success that she doesn't have to write another book for the rest of her life. And she hasn't. Now, basically, after the initial excitement over To Kill a Mockingbird, it died down about 50 years ago, Lee made the occasional personal appearance and rarely gave interviews to the media. She was more content living a quiet, low-key life in the family home in her native Monroeville with her older sister Alice, and preferred to be addressed by her original first name, which was Nell. Now, however, that changed in 2001 when Chicago Tribune journalist Marja Mills managed to obtain an interview with Lee on the occasion of the Chicago Library System selecting To Kill a Mockingbird to be in the spotlight for that year's One Book, One Chicago program. So Nell and Alice were so impressed with Mills and her article that an immediate friendship was struck between the three, in which the sisters managed to open up many aspects of their life to Mills, which was quite rare for them to be that close to a journalist. In fact, it got to the point that 3 years later, the Lee sisters gave Mills their blessing to live next door to them in Monroeville for a 15-month period. Now, the story of this unique friendship is told in loving, honest details in Mills' memoir, The Mockingbird Next Door. It chronicles various episodes that took place during that 15-month neighborly friendship, and the general impression you get is that Harper Lee had enough of the instant fame she got as a result of the book by 1962 and was content to live a quiet, simple life in Monroeville. However, the reader is also treated to various insights to her life in the book that made her famous, thanks to the confidence she had built between her and Mills. One of my favorite stories dealt with her very close friend Truman Capote, because she spoke about her friendship with the former, because Capote was her actual neighbor in Monroeville, and she also worked closely with him during the research phase of his legendary book In Cold Blood, and also about her frustrations over his claims that he contributed greatly to the writing of Mockingbird, which helped damage that friendship and was forever destroyed after his instant celebrity contributed to his downfall through alcoholism and drug abuse. Mm. This is quite an interesting book, Peter, to read, and as its relaxed tone shows a legendary author in her element and a way of life that she enjoyed living in. So if you ever wondered whatever happened to Harper Lee, The Mockingbird Next Door answers that question many times over. And with Lee now in her 90s and in frail health due to a stroke she suffered in 2007, this book is the closest thing we'll ever get to an autobiography of this remarkable woman and the literary classic that she wrote.
It's interesting because I was going to ask if there was mention of Truman Capote, but it's an interesting angle you said that they've touched on, and basically how that friendship has dissolved or had dissolved.
Yeah, it has. I mean, like I said, they worked very closely together when they were living in New York, and when he was writing in Cold Blood, especially doing the research in Holcomb, Kansas, in 1959, 1960, and she was writing Mockingbird at the same time also. So it's a very interesting, there's other interesting things that she touches upon in the book, but this is not only poignant, but almost, when you think about it, kind of tragic as well.
Is there anything in the book talking about the relationship that Harper had in the making of the movie?
Yeah, a lot. She was really comfortable with the choice of Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch, and in fact, she was so enamored of Gregory Peck portraying this title character, the lead character, that it struck up an automatic friendship that lasted till Peck's death in 2003.
I've often thought, watching the movie Saving Mr. Banks, mm-hmm. that would be an interesting movie in itself as well, because Saving Mr. Banks, of course, deals with the making of Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
And I was always curious to know what the making of Harper Lee's only book into a movie, and a very successful one at that, would have been like.
Well, I mean, there was no controversy per se. I mean, she was pretty satisfied with the person who wrote the screenplay, and she had a hand in, helping form the screenplay. I mean, there was no difficulty between, the cast and the director and Harper Lee. And so it was almost like, it was just something that went very well.
Okay.
There's no controversy.
Well, we have very little time. Anything else you recommend under this vein? Very quickly?
Well, I say read To Kill a Mockingbird. Also, in the same vein, read In Cold Blood as well. Because in a way, Harper Lee had a part in the making of that book, too.
Okay, Truman Capote's book, In Cold Blood.
Yeah.
And how can people find you, sir? They don't have to live next door to find you, do they?
No, then you don't have to look. Find me in Monroeville, Alabama, for that matter. You can find me in the Montreal Times in print every week or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost at a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have a few more Stuff File news stories to get to before we get to our idiot of the day. Louise Milan, who is 68, and her daughter Stephanie, who is 18, were sitting in their Evansville, Indiana home when there was a loud knock on the door. They heard a man yell, "Police department, search warrant! Police department, search warrant!" Then windows and doors smashed, flash grenades went off, and a SWAT team stormed their house. Police were responding to threats that had been posted on the internet using the wireless router in Milan's house. The FBI later arrested Derek Murray, who lived nearby, and pleaded guilty to using Milan's unprotected Wi-Fi connection to log on and post the threats. Milan said the police used much more force than was necessary just to search for information. "We're talking about a search warrant, not an arrest warrant," their lawyer said. Yes, they have a lawyer, so you know where this is going. The city, however, says a threat assessment determined that there were three known dangerous criminals associated with the house, and the level of response was appropriate. But not all that dangerous. They brought a TV news crew with them. Milan is, of course, suing the city. Sometimes, you know, the long arm of the law needs a slap on the wrist. Anyway, moving right along, a family in Seattle, Washington called 911 when a drunk woman wandered into their yard. It wasn't so much the trespass that startled the residents as the fact that she was quite on purpose exposing herself to them. But the final straw was when she hiked up her dress and engaged in an intimate act with several lawn chairs, according to police. Officers arrived quickly and arrested the unnamed 33-year-old woman for indecent exposure. You know, if those were my lawn chairs, I would just quietly burn them and then head to the Home Depot store to buy some new ones. 23-year-old Nigel Sykes wrote, "I committed a robbery at Seasons Pizza in Newport, Delaware. But after he stole $140, his gun was wrestled from him. That is when the assault began," he wrote. "All of the Seasons Pizza employees participated in punching, kicking, and pouring hot soup over my body. I was unarmed and defenseless and had to suffer a brutal beating by all the employees at Seasons Pizza." Sykes' account comes in a lawsuit against the pizzeria, some employees, and two cops. His first attempt to sue was thrown out of court, but he wrote another complaint, and this time federal judge Sue L. Robinson said he could proceed on some of his claims. Newport Police Chief Michael Capriglione said the judge was wasting tax money. "It's a joke lawsuit," he said. The irony is, of course, when you think about it, if he wins the lawsuit, it's kind of like the robbery worked. You see what I'm saying here? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our final story of the program. You know what that is, boys and girls. Yes, it's time once again for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
According to police, 20-year-old Nicholas Harris of St. Petersburg, Florida, planned to beat a man to death. He allegedly hit the man repeatedly in the face with a BB gun and, thinking that he was dead, put him in his car and drove home, where he dragged the man into the house. Police say Harris told his girlfriend and another unidentified person to help him bury the body and threatened them with a knife if they refused. A few hours later, the man woke up and Harris's mother and brother took him to the hospital. Harris was arrested and charged with first-degree attempted murder and multiple counts of battery, assault, false imprisonment, possessing a firearm as a felon, and burglary. Although classifying a BB gun as a firearm is kind of just piling on. But nevertheless, what kind of criminal cold cocks a person thinking he's dead, then drives him home like Weekend at Bernie's, then strong-arms others to bury the body, only to have the victim return from the dead and basically have you turned in by your mother? I'll tell you what kind of person. One kind and one kind only. An idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0265. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0265. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Before we go, we'd like to leave you with a helpful instructional message from the National Association of People Who Have Trouble Walking and Chewing Gum at the Same Time. Step, chew, step, chew, step, chew, step, step. Oh, God. I always screw it up.